Good morning. A new group in Gaza is preparing to deliver food guarded by Israeli soldiers. What do we know about the organization whose director resigned days ago, saying the
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo, filling in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, PFAS chemicals linked to cancer and other serious health risks are found in everyday items like makeup, cookware, and cleaning products. As the New York State Legislature considers two new bills to limit their use, we'll chat with experts on what the legislation could mean for the public health. A new affordable housing initiative is taking root in the Catskills. The Catskills Community Land Trust has launched its first pilot project, a two-family home in Rockland aimed to create a sustainable community-owned housing in the region. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar has details. And Ulster County is looking for young designers. The iVote sticker design is open. Radio Catskills' Miguel Santiago Colon reports on the Civic Education Initiative. But first, the news from NPR.
The Trump administration is seeking to strip Harvard of other funding, including significant financing of critical health care research. Harvard University President Alan Garber says federal funding is an investment used on behalf of humankind. He says taking it away from research universities means the critical work will not be done at all.
Why cut off research funding? Sure, it hurts Harvard, but it hurts the country, because after all, the research funding, it's not a gift. The research funding is given to universities and other research institutions to carry out work that the federal government designates as high priority work. It is work that they want done.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The Trump administration's cost-cutting team, DOGE, is trying to eliminate some of the surveys conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, the effort is raising concerns from government data watchers.
For this push to end some U.S. government surveys, the DOGE team created its own called the, quote, 2025 Survey of Surveys. NPR obtained a copy from a federal agency official who was not authorized to share it with the press. One of its questions is, quote, what are the implications if this survey were discontinued tomorrow? Some government data watchers are pointing out DOGE may be duplicating the oversight work of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, which is required by law to review all federal surveys. In a social media post on X, DOGE said its review has terminated five surveys, but did not name them. It did criticize questions about people's internet usage and alcohol consumption. Both topics have long been tracked by some of the surveys the Census Bureau conducts to produce statistics to help guide policymaking and research. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened higher this morning after President Trump postponed his threat to add steep new tariffs on imported goods coming from Europe. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 400 points in early trading.
President Trump has decided to wait at least another month before imposing a 50% import tax on EU goods. Trump said Friday that tax would take effect on June 1st. But after speaking with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen over the weekend, Trump agreed to wait until at least July 9th. In the meantime, negotiators from the U.S. and the EU will try to work out a trade deal. This continues a pattern in which the president threatens enormous import taxes, then backtracks. The tariffs that remain, however, are still the highest in nearly a century. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods fell last month for the first time in 5 months. That's mostly because of a steep drop in orders for commercial aircraft. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up about 400 points, or about 1%. The Nasdaq is up nearly 2%. You're listening to NPR. NPR and three Colorado public radio stations are suing the Trump administration. It's over President Trump's executive order recently, purportedly barring the use of congressionally appropriated funds for NPR and PBS. The White House has not had an immediate comment in reaction to the suit. Los Angeles County will start testing soils for toxins on property lots that were burned in the Eaton fire. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports the move's in response to concerns by scientists. Federal agencies are trying to fast-track recovery and rebuilding.
County health officials will collect soil samples from about 26,000 homes in and around Altadena. FEMA has been removing debris and clearing home sites for rebuilding, but not testing for lingering toxins in soils. Andrew Welton of Purdue University says this is a troubling departure in what's been standard protocol after other recent fires on Maui and in Paradise, California.
It's unclear to me why this is different. but it clearly is, and this is a problem towards a safe and rapid rebuilding.
The new LA County testing program is so far only planned in the Eaton Fire and not the similarly destructive Palisades Fire on the city's west side. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from a group representing Apache tribal members and environmentalists in Arizona. They're seeking to block a large copper mining project on federal land. The justice's ruling allows the transfer of the federal land to a group that plans to mine it. The opponents say this will destroy land that is sacred to Apaches. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo, sitting in for Tim Bruno. Two key environmental health bills are moving through the New York State legislature, and the clock is ticking. Lawmakers have until June 12th to pass critical legislation aimed at protecting New Yorkers from harmful PFAS chemicals found in everyday household items, from makeup and cookware to dental floss and cleaning products. The Beauty Justice Act and the PFAS in Consumer Products Acts are designed to phase out the use of the so-called forever chemicals that have been linked to serious health risks, including cancer, hormone disruption, and immune system issues. Joining us now with more details are Kate Donovan, the Northeast Environmental Health at the director of Northeast Environmental Health at the RNDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council, and Bobby Wilding, executive director of Clean Plus Healthy. Welcome both to the show.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with sort of some of the basics here. Kate, I don't know if you want to take this one. Let's start with what exactly are PFAS chemicals and why are they referred to as forever chemicals?
Yeah, so PFAS chemicals are a man-made synthetic chemical standing for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. As I mentioned, they're synthetic and they're man-made and they last forever, which is why you've often heard of them as forever chemicals. They bioaccumulate in the environment and in our bodies. And they were invented in the 50s and actually earlier for non-stick different purposes, as well as stain resistance purposes. And, you know, they have provided this modern convenience to us at the expense of our health and our environment.
So, you know, Where a PF, you know, you mentioned like, you know, the non-stick, so you normally you find those items in the kitchen, but where are PFAS most commonly found in household products and why should consumers be concerned? Bobby?
Yeah, so PFAS is actually in an alarming number of common consumer products. It can be the stain-resistant spray that or coating that you get added to your carpet or to your furniture. It can be in the pots and pans that make them nonstick. It can be, frankly, in your contacts or your dental floss. There are some really easy solutions to a number of these uses, including in pots and pans and for our furniture and floors, for our dental floss. And so there's a bill that would ban these PFAS and these really easy drop-in substitute replacement. You can live your life without PFAS easily products. And so we're looking to make sure that whether you know what PFAS is, whether you can pronounce that really long chemical name or you just think of them as forever chemicals or you don't think about them at all, that they're not coming into your home in a way that can harm your health and your family.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I've heard the word PFAS as a reporter, obviously do work on it, but I didn't really feel the effects or know the effects of it until I actually saw that movie called Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
That movie really opened my eyes to the PFAS and the dangers of it. So let's talk about the two bills now that's before the legislature. Can you explain, you know, exactly, first of all, what is the Beauty Justice Act and what would it do?
So the Beauty Justice Act is a bill that would ban PFAS and a host of other toxic chemicals from the personal care products that we use every day. So things like cancer-causing formaldehyde, other preservatives that have been shown to be harmful to our health, chemicals that can disrupt our hormones or contribute to cancer. And it covers a whole suite of these chemicals as a way of ensuring that we're all being protected. These are chemicals that often are showing up more disproportionately in products that are marketed to Black women, so hence the duty justice angle of this. But we're all being exposed to these chemicals, and everyone will benefit.
Wow. And Kate, I don't know if you want to talk about the PFAS and Consumers Product Act, like what types of items would this legislation cover, and how would it protect consumers?
Yeah, absolutely. So the PFAS and Consumer and Household Products really tackles what we just said. The products that we know PFAS is being used in, and we know that they're available, safer alternatives on the market. So that bill would cover banning the use of PFAS in textiles, in rugs, in dental floss, nonstick cookware, ski wax, children's products, paint, cleaning products. So it's a real host. I mean, all of those products you find in every single room of your home, right? Moving from your bathroom to your kitchen to your living room to your children's room. So it is a really great start, or, you know, a continuation, I suppose, of the New York State's effort to ban these really dangerous chemicals from their use and exposure.
Right. Now, you know, where do exactly these bills currently stand in the whole legislative process? You know, what needs to happen before the June 12th deadline, Bobby?
Yeah. So the Beauty Justice Act is on the floor in the Senate, which means that the Senate could choose to vote on it at any time. And it's in the Ways and Means Committee in the Assembly, which is basically one step away from reaching the full Assembly for a vote. The PFAS and Consumer Products Ban Bill is actually passed the Senate last week and is awaiting a vote from the Assembly.
Okay. Now, Kate, you know, I understand that New York has passed PFAS bans before. How do these bills build on the work that has been done already?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, New York has already banned the use of PFAS in firefighting foam, paper-based food packaging, carpets, as well as apparel. And these all build on each other because what we're doing in New York, I mean, ultimately, we have concerns of course, using products with PFAS. And there is no doubt, you know, no doubt we are concerned about ingesting, inhaling, sitting, you know, on these products, having our kids close to these chemicals and products. But also, New York has a huge water contamination crisis, PFAS water contamination crisis. And ultimately, what happens is that the production and the use of these chemicals end up in our waters. So they also end up in our bodies, but they get put down drains through cleaning products. They get disposed of in our trash if you're throwing out all sorts of household products that end up in our landfills, which leach into our water supplies, not to mention all the different factories and manufacturing facilities across New York State that manufacture all sorts of products. And we know that PFAS is emitted from water effluents as well as air because those are not highly regulated at this point in time. So the solution to kind of building on this is stopping the use of PFAS upstream, because that is the only way we're going to tackle the downstream contamination issues.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, just going to go back a little bit. I think, Bobby, you mentioned about when we were talking about the Beauty Justice Act, you mentioned about, you know, having the word justice in it, that some of these products are marketed to Black women. So why let's just talk about that. Why is PFAS regulations not just an environmental issue, but it's also a matter of health equity and justice?
So PFAS is used in a lot of different places. And one of the things that we're concerned about is manufacturing facilities typically are placed in communities who have less political clout. So that's usually communities of color or low income. And so that ends up being a source of a whole host of toxic chemicals. Additionally, when you have products that are specifically marketed to people of color to achieve a Eurocentric beauty standard, you end up with more of these toxic chemicals being used in that way. And so it's really, this is really, our bills are aimed at achieving environmental justice by removing this burden from people who are already overburdened in the case of products that, all Americans are using every day, but also addressing those products that are disproportionately impacting women of color in particular.
So, you know, what do you say to the critics that, or the industry, when they claim that, you know, removing PFAS is just too costly and nearly impossible?
I mean, to start here, I mean, it, I'll go ahead, start, Bobby, and then you can jump. Jump in. It's a little bit hard when we're tag teaming here.
Yeah, sorry about that. No worries.
Well, they're not factoring in the health costs, right?
Right.
We know that Americans are sicker than ever. Our health costs, care costs in the United States, but in New York, are, you know, extraordinary. And the exposure to these chemicals has all sorts of health risks. We're not just talking about, say, cancers, which of course are a terrible result, but we're talking about, you know, immunosuppression, reducing the effectiveness of uptakes in vaccines, just high cholesterol, low birth weight. All of these things have costs over a long period of time that are, and quite frankly, quite difficult to monetize.
Now, do you imagine the fight can be tougher now with the current administration, you know, rolling back some regulations that have been in place or attempting to roll back some regulations in place? Do you feel like this is sort of a bigger fight, has become a bigger fight than before?
Well, I just want to say one thing before you jump in, Bobby, is that the irony of the administration is undeniable. They are in one space rolling back our water protections and then another space, you know, talking about the dangers of PFAS in paper straws, the dangers of PFAS and the impact of chemicals on our health and our environment. So, you know, it remains to be seen, but by stripping the EPA and removing the funding and then removing water protections just is the biggest hypocrisy. And very difficult to reconcile in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's also just, I will say, it's pretty shocking when you, just getting back to your previous question about costs, analyses of what it costs just to sort of like keep at our steady state of how much PFAS is in our environment globally is in the trillions of dollars. But the amount of money that the companies that are using PFAS are making is in the billions of dollars. So the cost that we are incurring, you know, the industry might say that it's costly, but in fact, the burden being put on the public around the world is at least 100 times higher than the profits that these companies are earning. So they're asking us to take on a huge burden so that they can make a little bit more. And I would also say that a lot of times the solutions are actually cost effective and cost comparable to what PFAS products use or cost.
Yeah. Well, Bobby, let's stick with you. With the end of the legislative season approaching, you know, what actions can our listeners, New Yorkers, can take if they want to support or engage with these PFAS related bills?
Yeah. So we're actually going to be releasing today a group of legislators who are part of what we're calling the Team Tackling Toxics. That's 48 legislators who are sponsoring or co-sponsoring major PFAS legislation in the Assembly and Senate. And along with that, we're calling on them to make sure that these bills move. So legislators, so people around the state can call their legislator and urge them to support the bills that address PFAS, getting across the finish line, talking with their colleagues, supporting the Beauty Justice Act and the PFAS and Consumer Products Act. That is huge. Talking about it on social media, tagging your legislators in it on social media, those are also really great ways to spread the word and make sure legislators realize that their constituents are talking about this really important issue.
Yeah. Now, Kate, you know, while that's going on, how can consumers protect themselves in the meantime? Are there any sort of practical steps that they can take to reduce PFAS exposure in their everyday life?
I mean, we always say that there's keywords to just be on the lookout for. So if you see products being marketed as stain resistant, waterproof, wrinkle free, Those are good, those are products I would stay away from in my own home. But ultimately, it shouldn't be the consumer's responsibility. And that's what we're really fighting for, to create an even playing field.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you mentioned a little bit, I just want to reiterate that again. Where can listeners go to learn more about these bills and your organization's work on this issue?
So I would say that we do have some social media at PFASFreeNY.org is the website, and there's a PFASFreeNY Instagram site. And I know Bobby also on her organization's social and website has information, and Bobby, you might want to provide that.
Well, I would actually direct people to foreverfables.org. We are releasing a new book that's a picture book talking about PFAS to make it a little bit more easy to access for all of us. But there's a website that goes along with it that has an explainer and also has a link out to folks being able to take action on the PFAS and consumer products bill. So it's foreverfables.org.
Right. Well, Kate and Bobby, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on you want our listeners to know about?
I would just say,
great.
Thanks for having us. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, thank you so much for, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just think that this is really urgent, right? Mm-hmm. As Kate mentioned, we're seeing rollbacks at the federal level. We're seeing inconsistencies in messages across the federal government. And when New York takes action, like the Beauty Justice Act and its ban on PFAS and consumer products, it doesn't just protect New Yorkers. It is going to have a huge impact on the national marketplace because companies don't just make products for New York. So we in New York can be a real anchor for protecting Americans from these toxic forever chemicals by taking action this legislative session.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we're talking to Kate Donovan of the NRDC and Bobby Welding of the Clean and Healthy. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your expertise on this very important and critical issue.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, in the town of Rockland, a new housing project is taking shape. Two family duplex designed to provide affordable, sustainable homes for local families. We'll learn more about the Catskills Community Land Trust pilot project next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Roballo. Imagine in an affordable rental home constructed with local timber, local workforce, and with cutting-edge green technology built by the community for the community. Well, that is what the Catskills Community Land Trust is hoping to bring to Livingston Manor. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke to the trust team about the vision to bring affordable housing to Sullivan County.
A new community land trust wants to build affordable housing in Livingston Manor. The Catskills Community Land Trust wants to transform a quarter-acre lot into green, affordable homes by and for the community. Here to talk about it is Gwen Shantz and Bruce Pollock, advisory committee members of the Catskills Community Land Trust. The trust's mission is to hold and develop land as a shared asset to build and preserve affordable homes. Gwen and Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kim.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So let's start with the basics. What is a community land trust, or CLT for short, and how would it work in Livingston Manor?
So a community land trust is based on this model of shared equity, where the idea is that land or other assets are owned and shared collectively by people who live in an area. So you could have a park maybe that's not owned by the government, but if it's owned by a nonprofit organization, that could be seen as like a collective asset that's open to the public and it's there to benefit the community. The Catskills Community Land Trust is a nonprofit organization, and our goal is to acquire land and develop housing that we can hold on to for the community and keep at an affordable rate. So primarily, we'll be working with rentals, with apartments that will be affordable to people making a middle income in our area. And I'll define affordable housing in this case as housing that costs less than 30% of your income if you're making a living wage, a working wage in this area.
And the project that you're currently working on, can you tell me a little bit more about what that could possibly look like? What are you proposing?
Well, the town of we're working with the town of Rockland, and they've identified a lot in the village that's what's the size, quarter acre?
Yeah, it's about a quarter acre.
Yeah, and they're going to sell that to us at a fairly reasonable rate, and we'll be able to do our first project there. But as far as the actual structures, we've zeroed in on an idea of using timber frames because we can source the lumber locally for the timber. We have people in the area that know how to harvest trees. We have people in the area that know how to mill the trees. And we have people that know how to stand up. It's basically a barn frame. It's the same construction method that has been used for all those old barns that you see.
Yeah, I think the proposal is especially unique because its focus is on housing local families, but also fostering local in terms of utilizing actual local resources, like you described. I think another thing I think is interesting is just the timing of bringing a community land trust to the Catskills. It feels especially urgent right now. I was looking at some of the data from the Pattern for Progress. They just released some new housing data this week that shows that the inventory of homes for sale in Sullivan County has dropped 70% in the last 6 years, from 2019 to 2025, which is such a substantial decrease. And I'm curious, from your perspectives, why it's so important to build affordable housing right now in the region, and how you define affordable housing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a national problem, right? Everyone's heard about the housing crisis nationally, and this is a state priority for the state government. The county, Sullivan County government, is really prioritizing promoting more affordable housing development. And it's something that locally on the municipal level in the town of Rockland, the town leadership is really pushing for. And they've recently signed up for the New York State Pro Housing Community Program. So like Bruce said, we've been working closely with the town government to try to develop a model that'll work for our town. And all of these towns are unique, but what we see over and over again in the Catskills are these small villages and hamlets in river valleys with steep slopes. And so we don't have big open spaces, particularly on water and sewer systems, where we can build homes. So we're really looking to build small developments, maybe one or two houses here or there, and ideally eventually renovating some of the condemned or substandard homes in our communities as well. So we have a lot of opportunities to solve this problem, and we're eager to be working with state and county sources and even federal sources for funding and other programs that can help us get this done. But what we're realizing, and what Bruce and I and our fellow volunteers at the Catskill Community Land Trust are doing, is realizing that nobody's going to come in here and solve this problem for us. It's really up to the local community to step up and get some houses built. And for-profit developers can't afford to do this. So we're doing it as a nonprofit organization. And our hope is to take donations and grant money and put it to work for our local community.
I think anybody that's been paying attention has to realize that the home prices and even the rents are out of reach of most people now. This area, Sullivan County in general, excuse me, suffers from we've got a triple whammy going on. We're very close to New York City. We have been discovered as a great place for second home ownership, and the Airbnbs have jumped in addition to all of that. So one thing, I'm partially, I blame myself because I participated in some of that activity. I've rehabbed two homes and sold them to people from the city. And I've built a new home and sold it to someone from the city. So not that I'm guilt-ridden. I'm right. just saying that I need to do something to help fix this.
Yeah. Where are you guys now in terms of bringing the pilot home to life?
So right now we're raising money for this land purchase. We need to raise $18,000 to buy the land from the town of Rockland. And we feel good about buying the land from the town because we know that that money is going right into the town coffers and it will be used by the town government in responsible ways. And then once we acquire the land, we will begin fundraising and organizing for the next phase, which is actual construction. And one of the most exciting parts of this project, aside from sourcing local materials like local timber, is that we're going to be building one of the greenest houses in town. It will be a really tight house, really beautifully built, very strong. It'll last for 100 years or more, built like an old barn, just like Bruce said. But it will also use some really modern technologies in terms of insulation and windows and electric heating. And so it will be a really cozy, green, energy-efficient house with great air quality, and it'll be a really high standard of living for the people who live there. Mm-hmm. Wow. And while we build it, we'll be working with Sullivan BOCES to take on the construction. So we'll be educating young people on how to build a house like this. What are the cutting-edge green technologies at our disposal?
Mm-hmm. For those who don't know what BOCES is a trade school, local trade school.
Right.
And so we're hoping to help train the next generation of construction workers in the area.
That's incredible. And I think the way that you describe the home, it sounds like a dream. I'm like, when can I move in? that makes me think of one question around eligibility. You talked about how you define affordable housing. What would the process be for someone moving in?
That's a good question. We're not really sure yet, because if we acquire grant funding from certain sources, we might be required to follow their guidelines on how we can advertise and rent out the home. If all of our money is privately sourced, and as in if everyone just donates a little bit and we are able to raise that money independent of major grant programs, then we can have a lot more flexibility with how we rent it out. But what we do know is that at least one of the apartments will be rented at an affordable rate, so 30% of monthly income, to a low-income household. And low-income just means a family that's making less than 60% of area median income. And then the second apartment will be rented to a family making a moderate income, ideally. So you'll have kind of a mixed income community where you have a lower income family living next door to a more middle class right. family. And the idea is not to create neighborhoods where everybody is in one class. We're hoping that we maintain this wonderful aspect of our community in Livingston Manor, where we have people who make all sorts of different levels of income living side by side. And that type of economic diversity and class diversity is really one of the great things about Livingston Manor. So we want to build on that and maintain it as we move forward.
Very exciting stuff in the works. I'm curious, how can people stay plugged in or get involved with the project potentially?
Well, we do have a website. It's Catskills Community Land Trust, CatskillsCLT.org. So you can find us online. We just started an Instagram page, so you can also find us at Catskills Community Land Trust. Yeah, we'd love to hear from everybody. We're always looking to add to our advisory committee. We're looking for local talent. There's six of us now who are organizing this, and we have a great group who are leading the charge. But it really takes a village, so everyone is welcome. And we thank you so much, Kim, for giving us this opportunity today.
Thank you, Kim.
Of course. I've been chatting with Gwen Chance and Bruce Pollock, advisory members of the Catskills Community Land Trust. Bruce and Gwen, thanks so much for chatting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this project evolve.
Thank you.
You can find more information on the Catskills Community Land Trust on their website at catskillscommunitylandtrust.org. And we have our reporter, Camille Izar, in the studio with us, who did the interview right here in the studio. Hello. Hello, Kim. It'd be good if I turn your microphone on.
Hey, Patricio, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to bring you in to talk more about the Community Land Trust, as well as some of the sort of the broader issues reporting that you have been reporting lately. We heard from the Catskills Community Land Trust, where we learned a lot about the innovative solution to address affordable housing. When did the Community Land Trust first come about, and how have they since been used in New York?
Yeah, definitely. So Community Land Trusts have actually been around for a really long time. It has its roots in affordable housing, actually. So in the 1960s, in rural Georgia, white farmers actually were evicting their black tenant farmers for essentially participating in the civil rights movement. So black farmers were getting ready to register to vote. They were getting ready to enroll their kids in integrated schools, and white farmers in Georgia did not like that. So obviously they started to, you know, evict their tenants. And because these black farmers no longer had an address, they couldn't register to vote. So that is obviously a huge barrier. And so what happened was, in response, black farmers in 1969, they pooled, community and grant funding together and purchased 6,000 acres of land, which is really incredible.
Yeah.
And that is actually how the first Community Land Trust was born.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A little history lesson there. So, you know, we heard from Gwen and Bruce about the rising cost and the unaffordability in the area. What can you tell us about the housing insecurity in the Catskill region?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no secret that housing costs are still rising, even after the COVID housing boom that we saw in the region in 2020. And there's actually some recent data that I want to point to.
Mm-hmm.
So the housing nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, they actually put out some information the last few weeks. And in the Hudson Valley region overall, and Pattern for Progress, they define this region as Sullivan, Ulster, Orange counties, as well as several other counties. The inventory of homes for sale in the last 6 years went from more than 12,000 to less than 5,000.
Wow.
That is such a significant decrease in only 6 years. And keep in mind that this is happening while the average home sale is still increasing, mm-hmm. right? We're seeing that in almost every county in the Hudson Valley region, the average home sale price has increased by almost 50%.
Wow.
And in Sullivan County specifically, the average home sale price, and I was shocked when I was looking at these numbers, it went from 130K to more than 330,000 in wow. even just the last 6 years. What's interesting about this data is that for the first quarter of this year so far, the inventory of homes for sale has actually increased just a little bit. And the nonprofit, you know, Pattern for Progress, they're not 100% sure exactly why. They're unsure if it's maybe, you know, baby boomers who are retiring, they're selling their homes, or maybe it's residents who bought their home during the COVID, you know, housing boom. They're having buyer's remorse and they're reselling their home. They said it's too early to tell, but that the cost of homes are, you know, still expected to go up.
So what about renters? You know, you talk about homeowners, but what are the trends have you seen for home renters?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm a home, you know, I'm a home renter myself. And I will say that I think what we're seeing for renters isn't much better. In fact, it's actually probably worse, because renters often are at the whims of landlords. I do want to point out one important state law that passed last year mm-hmm. that offers a lot of renter protections. It's called Good Cause Eviction. And I think a lot of people upstate aren't familiar with it. So essentially what good cause eviction does is that it means that landlords cannot evict a tenant without having some sort of good cause. And it also offers like a number of other tenant protections. The tricky thing about this legislation is that good cause eviction, it applies in New York City. But if you're upstate where we are,
mm-hmm.
the town or city has to opt in to good cause eviction.
Oh, okay.
It's not like an automatic thing
yeah.
like what we see in New York City. So Kingston, New Paltz, Catskill, they have all opted in. But unless your town or city has opted in, then you may likely you're probably not protected under this. So if you know if you're curious and want to know more, there's actually a really great housing nonprofit called For the Many.
For the Many.
For the Many, and they actually have a tenant hotline that connects people to resources. They also have a tenant, housing hotline that connects people to resources. Their website is housingforthemany.org.
So, you know, you've been covering, you know, local housing closely lately this past month, specifically the debate to bring Gateway Housing Facility to Sullivan County.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us more about this, exactly what is happening and what is the, sort of the latest on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a local issue that's being followed very closely for residents here in Sullivan County. So essentially, the Sullivan County Legislature has been exploring the possibility of bringing a gateway housing shelter to Thompson, New York, on Petaluma Road for months now. And Sullivan County currently doesn't have a homeless shelter. It hasn't for,
I believe it ever.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever had a homeless shelter. And currently the county uses kind of like this patchwork system mm-hmm. of relying on hotels and motels. And what happened was in April, the legislature, they failed to authorize this housing proposal. The majority of legislators actually approved it, but they needed a supermajority vote. And then several weeks later, something changed. And the legislature actually voted not to schedule a public hearing for the housing shelter. So what that means is that the legislature actually has to go back to the drawing board to search for other new location sites. So the latest essentially is that they will reconvene on Thursday, June 19th, and talk about possible site locations from there.
Well, you know, like I said, you'll be following the story definitely as it unfolds. But what other housing stories can we expect from you that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to continue to follow the housing shelter story, but I'm also just working on examining the region's housing crisis more broadly, specifically how rising housing costs have really impacted tenants and homeowners, but also like our hospitals, our public infrastructure. You know, housing is a big impact on our water and waste mm-hmm. systems. So I'm really eager to hear from people who have been impacted by housing in this region, people directly affected. My email inbox is always open if people want to get in touch with me. My email is kimberly@wjffradio.org, and I really hope to hear from some of y'all.
Well, thank you so much. We're talking to Kimberly Izar, the reporter for that story you just heard on housing. Thank you so much for that, Kimberly. I do really appreciate it. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Ulster County is looking for young designers 9 to 18 to create a new I Voted sticker. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill, and I'm Patricio Roballo, calling all young artists with a passion for democracy. Ulster County's annual I Voted sticker design contest is accepting submissions from students ages 9 to 18 who want to make their mark on the 2025 election. The winning designs will be featured on the official I Voted stickers distributed at polling places throughout Ulster County during the general election on November 4th. Inspired by some of the programs in other states, the contest has quickly embraced by the community since its initiative began in 2020. At Radio Catskill's Miguel Santiago Colon spoke to Commissioner for Ulster County Board of Elections, Alicia Torres, about this contest. Not only does it give students a platform to express themselves artistically, but it also connects them directly to the democratic process, one sticker at a time.
Yeah, so I came up with the idea for this contest a couple of years ago. I've been the commissioner since 2017. And when I became commissioner, I had all these great ideas that I wanted to do, but it really took cooperation from my Republican counterpart. And so when I got a new Republican counterpart in 2020, we decided, you know, let's try this project out that I had been talking about for a couple of years, how to get students, younger people involved in the process. And when I was a kid, I was really into art, and I never really thought that I would be working in like a government or a political space. I thought I was going to be like this famous artist and be doing that. So I knew that there are different ways to approach how you engage with your government, with civics. And I thought, you know, we have always wanted to have the I voted stickers. I think the ones that are bought in bulk and mass with a little waving American flag don't really inspire excitement. So I always thought it would be fun to give power to young people who, even though all of the students that have participated in our contest aren't even old enough to vote yet, they can have a really big impact on their community and use their artistic expression to convey their thought on what voting is. And we've had a really great experience with that. It sort of always blows me away when we have our event with the winner and they explain to us their concept of why they made their design look the way that they did. And they're always super thoughtful about it. And it just gives me hope in sort of this bleak political climate that we live in, that, you know, the kids are all right and they are going to take over everything one day. And if they're anything like the winners that we've had in the last couple of years, I think we're in good hands.
Could you walk us through just some of the winners of these contests? What those drawings look like? Just like, what are the main ones that stood out to you?
So we've had, of course, you know, your traditional red, white, and blue. Some of them have had people just like holding up either a political sign or with their fist in the air. But we've also had some really off the wall ones. Of course, our most famous sticker is the spider humanoid sticker that we had in 2022 that Hudson Rowan from Rondout Valley High School that he made. And that really gripped people, especially that was a big federal congressional year, and a lot of people connected to it and put their own imprint on what it meant to them onto it. When you asked him what he thought about it, he was very nonchalant in a very cool and very 14-year-old way. Like, I just made it on my iPad. My mom said I should do this contest, and I made it in like 5 minutes, and I thought it looked cool. Okay.
And one.
One. And, but some of the other ones, we had one that was a Statue of Liberty, and the artist on that one, Juliana, she was very politically minded on it. She said, you know, the Statue of Liberty to me as a New Yorker, as an American, it means welcoming people. It's this gateway for immigrants and what that means to then become a citizen and a voter. And I thought that was really profound. The one we had last year, it was a pink cat saying that I voted. The student for that from Miller Middle School in Kingston, she was very sort of like, I liked the way that it looked, but I also felt like it was welcoming and friendly and that people would like wearing it after they voted. So they've all had their different spins on it. And it's always been this mindfulness. And we've some of our runners up last year, the one that I really liked, it was Bigfoot going to vote. I thought that was sort of interesting because we live in a more of a rural area. I thought that was cool. There was also an alien spaceship coming down to vote. So I voted for that one, but it didn't win. So that's okay. I thought those were cool.
I know the submissions have been open for quite a bit. Could you share with us just what the timeline looks like? How
sure.
do you guys
so,
work around it?
We opened up submissions on the 15th of April, and it's still open for, you know, a couple more weeks to up through June 30th. So we want to give the students as much time as possible up through their last few weeks of class at the end of June. Most of them will be wrapping up school. we know they got a lot going on. They've got sports, they've got clubs, they've got their final exams, all the things that stress out students. And so if they want to participate, we don't want to give them, you know, like a 2 weeks. We want to give them a few months to do it. It, of course, takes some time for submissions to come in. We have started getting some submissions back already, a handful, but we usually get anywhere from 50 to 150 submissions back. And so, and they usually come towards the end of the contest. So we're anticipating that we'll get more. And I thank you for helping us get the word out too. So people know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. It's a local year for elections. So a lot of people aren't really as conscious that we have elections every year. So we do this contest every year. And we want to make sure that the students who do want to participate, they know that they've got plenty of time.
I know that you mentioned that some of the winners out there, you know, it's quite varied, just the ones that wind up winning. But what do you take into consideration while evaluating the submissions? Are you looking for something specific? Is there a theme that whoever submits needs to follow?
So when I look at them, when I do my selections, in the past we've done it in our office, and we have our staff of, there's 14 of us that work here full time. We sort of select our top three. When I look at mine, I look for uniqueness. I look for, you know, the something interesting that'll attract people's eye. I don't want it to be like too controversial, because then I know. Even though these are kids and they have their own freedom of expression, I've seen where some people have, you know, especially with the spider sticker, because it got so much attention, overwhelmingly positive, but there were some negative comments that stuck out to me. So that didn't sway me from picking it or not picking it. But this year, with that in mind, and because the county, Ulster County, is starting a new arts, culture, an open space initiative through the tourism department, I reached out to those folks and asked them if they could help us bring on some people from the art community in Ulster County to help us select the finalists. So we're going to be doing that this year for the first time. And I'm really excited to see from their sort of arts and civic perspective who they might choose out of our big pool of submissions that we anticipate getting. So we have, let's see, there's six people joining both myself and my Republican counterpart, John, in picking the finalists. And before, we haven't done that before, so I'm really interested to see when they look at all of them, what sticks out to them.
And who will the panel be composed of?
Sure. So it's myself and my counterpart, John Quigley. And then we have Danielle Bliss. She owns Wishbone Letterpress. It's a greeting card company located in Kingston. She also runs the Hudson Valley Hullabaloo Holiday Market, which is in Kingston. We have Vanessa Cappuccio Bear. She's from Arts Mid-Hudson. We have Maggie Ingy. She's the board president of Midtown Kingston Arts District. Then we have Melanie Martin. She's the sales director for the New York Foundation for the Arts. Brian Andrews, he's the executive director of the Center for Creative Education in Kingston. And then we'll also have the new director of the Arts, Culture, and Open Space Committee. They have not been hired yet, so whoever the county tourism department chooses, that will be their first work assignment, is being on this I Voted Sticker selection panel.
For those who want to participate in the contest, what should they know beforehand and how can they submit their work?
Yeah, sure. So the age range that we allow for submitting the contest is 9 through 18. They need to be a student who lives in Ulster County. The design we leave really up to the student. We just let them know that it will be shrunk down to a 2-inch circle so that we can print it on the sticker. And it just has to include the word I voted somewhere on it, but then we leave the rest up to the artist. The medium can be really anything, hand-drawn, in crayon or pencil. They could paint something. We've received digital artwork back on iPads, on the computer. So we're really liberal as far as that goes, how they make it. They can submit a picture, so they can take a photo, PDF or JPEG, and then they have to email it to us. And our email address is elections@do.ulster.ny.us.
And just to make sure, they don't need any drawing experience prior, right?
None whatsoever.
What about those who want to vote in the contest? How should they proceed? I believe it's going to be also open to the public, right?
Yeah. So once we have the finalists selected, and we're going to do that the first week of July, so that the second week of July, we will have the contest open on our website, voteulster.com. And it's an online contest. So people from Ulster County, we've also had people vote that don't live in Ulster County, especially when it got so much attention in 2022. We had votes coming from all over the country. So we don't inhibit anybody from voting in the contest. We do inhibit how many votes you can do from a device. So it's one vote per device. And so we block multiple votes coming from any particular IP address so that we avoid any, you know, spam bots or any kind of manipulation of the voting process as far as how many votes you can cast. And that's the only limitation that we put on the online voting. We'll have that open for a month. We'll close that out in the middle of August. And then we'll announce the winner once people go back to school that first week of September. We'll do our big announcement, and then we'll have an event with them, with the county legislature, and they get awards, they get all kinds of press. And then, of course, the big prize is having that sticker published and given out during early voting and all of our poll sites on Election Day.
And before we finish, how would you say the contest has shaped just the people who participate in, like, what's been the feedback that you've gotten since it started?
The feedback has been really great. I mean, people really love the contest. I hear back from people that it's the reason that they went and voted in person is because they wanted to get the sticker. And if that's the motivation it takes for them to go and participate in their election process, then I think that that's a great outcome. We have gotten a lot of attention from other boards of elections, other states that their secretaries of state that run their elections. And we've heard from people all over the country, Colorado, Michigan, Arizona, Maryland, that have replicated our contest with students in their own jurisdictions and have had similar results. And it's been really cool to see how what started as just like this fun idea we had for kids and students, how it has exploded, and other students from these other places around the country have also been able to participate in this way. We've really tried hard to do outreach to younger kids out. We go out in the field. I've got a mock election that I'm going to do next week up in at Bennett School in the Oniorna School District. And we'll bring stickers with us. We'll talk about the contest. And we're also going to let them vote in a pretend election. We do stuff like that. We have our coloring book, too, that we have at all of our poll sites. So if you go and vote with mom and dad, you can leave with that teaches you all about Ulster County voting, history of New York State, the history of voting. We have the sticker contest is featured in the coloring book as well. So we really, our board really feels strongly that, you know, we want to make sure that the next generation knows that they have the power to shape the way that their government works and how it works for them. And we think that the best way to penetrate that, we don't want to wait until, you know, a month before they turn 18 when we go to high schools. We want to start that early so that they get that that comfortable sense of knowing that they have support from people like myself, like my counterpart, that are here to help them. So they're not afraid to ask questions. How do I register to vote? We don't want to make it harder. We want to make it easier for people. And I think starting people as young as we can is the best way to do that.
Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Torres, thank you so much for being here with us at Radio Catskill. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Liberty, I'm Miguel Santiago Colon for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much to Miguel for that story, and thank you to Ulster County Board of Elections. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Just took a quick look at the weather today. Increasing clouds with a high near 72. Tonight, cloudy with a low of around 51. And Wednesday, a chance of showers, mainly after 1 p.m. Cloudy with a high of around 64. Wednesday night, rain likely. Cloudy with a low around 50. Again, this is Radio Catskill, and I was Patrice Robalvi, your host for Radio Catskill. Thanks for listening.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome back.
Bryan Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill.